It's Jimbo Times!
William Aceves, I want to thank you so very much for joining me for the 96th episode of JT the LA Storyteller Podcast. What an honor. And how are you doing on this Monday evening, the start of the work week for us all?
I'm doing great, JT. Thanks so much. I'm so excited to be participating. I love the idea of storytelling as a means to communicate and to share ideas and history with people.
I really appreciate you saying that, because I feel as though no matter where we are in the world and where we are as human beings developing their minds, their perspectives each day, there's this sort of common thread, whether you're in academia or whether you're a journalist or whether you're someone just at the library in need of a good read. And it's this love for stories, and especially stories that are authentic and that speak to folks in these genuine and relatable terms. And so I really appreciate you saying that, because no matter where we are, I feel stories bring all of us together. They connect us through and through. So before all of the major storytelling that you've participated in recently, why don't you say a little bit about your time in LA and a little bit about where you are now? I think this will just help ground us for a moment as we get into some of the major storytelling work you've been doing.
Sure, of course. I was born and raised in Los Angeles. I grew up in Westchester, so near LAX. I went to high school toward North Central LA, so Loyola High School, the corner of Venice and Normandy. From there, I then went to undergraduate at Claremont McKenna College, which is in Claremont near Pomona, and then went back to LA for law school at the University of Southern California. When I graduated from SC, I then practiced law for a couple years, 1 year working for a small law firm in downtown LA, and then the second year working for legal aid in Santa Monica. After that, I then went to graduate school in government back in Boston. Then came back to LA to go to UCLA Law School. I couldn't get enough of education, so I went back to law school to get an advanced law degree. And then I couldn't think of any other degrees I wanted to get, so I started working as an academic, which is where I am now. I teach law at California Western Law School in San Diego.
That's so cool. And tell me a little bit about, especially now when you think of LA, what are a few places, a few intersections, or just a handful of spots that are especially LA for you?
Oh, my goodness. Well, when I grew up in LA, it was a time when Westwood was very vibrant and active. So Westwood has a special place in my heart. Of course, Rampart and Beverly is also a place that's close to my heart, because that's where the original Tommy's is located. And I will always remember that intersection. It's so funny, because I do often think about Los Angeles in terms of street corners and geography. And so I can think of La Cienega and Venice Boulevard, which is where the bus would let us from one line to the other to eventually get back home to Westchester. So really, there are many aspects, many places in the city that I have very fond memories of.
That's so cool. And you are definitely a real one for shouting out Tommy's there on Rampart and Beverly. That is a classic. You're actually the first guest on the show to shout out Tommy's at that intersection. So you know you're speaking to a real LA aficionado. To the listenership out there, if you've not yet visited Tommy's, especially on a late night, after work, after time with some friends hanging out, you have got to do it. It is a heartfelt place for so many of us in the city of Los Angeles. So absolutely, William, that is really cool. And yeah. So tell us a little bit about some of the major storytelling work that you've gotten to do, especially as of late. We just sort of saw the month of April pass. And of course, for Los Angeles, in my view, The month of April is always the year of 1992, somewhere, somehow, for someone in the city of Los Angeles, even for someone like me who didn't necessarily grow up during that time, it still speaks very vividly to what LA remains well into the 21st century, a quarter through the 21st century. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about how you started excavating this fascinating history relating to Watts and the 1992 LA Rebellion, or uprising, as they say.
Yes. So in April of 1992, I was working with Legal Aid in Santa Monica. And so I do remember that initial first day and the days after when the uprising began. And at that time, I was already engaged in social, certainly social awareness, and I would dare say social activism as well. And over the years, I had heard stories about a treaty that had been entered into among several gangs from the Watts community. And I always thought that was really interesting phrasing, using the term treaty, which is something we normally think about countries using to solve conflict. And I didn't really find much several years ago, many years ago, when I started looking into it. And so I'd always put it into a research folder, as many academics do. And about 2 years ago, I went back to that folder and started doing a little bit more digging. And this time I was successful in that I was able to find news articles. I was eventually able to track down some of the treaty drafters, the gang members who had decided that if they didn't do something to end the violence that was afflicting their community, nobody else was going to stop it. And so these gang members, these leaders, these activists essentially came together and tried to figure out a way to end their conflict. And they came up with really a brilliant idea. They recognized that what they were involved with was an armed conflict. You had assault rifles, you had targeted killings, you had the killing of innocent civilians, you had no man's land where gang members could not enter. And they realized that that was essentially describing what many countries have gone through. And so they thought it might be worthwhile to look and see if there was some type of a treaty or international agreement that they could look to as a template to draft their own peace treaty. And so one of these gang members visited the University of Southern California and visited one of the libraries there, the library that specialized in international relations. And working with one of the reference librarians, he discovered the 1949 armistice agreement between Egypt and Israel. He then sat down in the library stacks and copied by hand that treaty. He brought it back to leaders in the gang, and they reworded it. And I know it sounds so interesting, but they essentially replaced Egypt and Israel with the respective gangs from their community. And they brought it to the other leaders, and the leadership agreed to it. And that was about 30 years ago. And that took place just a few days before the LA uprisings began, which as you know, occurred in response to the jury verdict finding the police officers who had brutally beaten Rodney King innocent. Once that jury verdict was issued, people got angry. There was an uprising. There was a rebellion in Los Angeles. And the story that I was telling, the story about the Watts Peace Treaty, was highlighting the fact that despite this uprising, there were no gang deaths during that uprising. And in fact, in the weeks and months after the uprising, this treaty that had been entered into by the gangs in the Watts community held. And so the number of killings decreased significantly during the weeks and months after the treaty was enacted. Community members noticed it. Police noticed it. Local hospitals noticed it. And so to me, that is amazing, that these individuals who have been ostracized by society, who did not receive any meaningful support by politicians, by the cities that they were members of, they took it into their own hands and they tried to create something that would protect their families and save themselves. And it held. And for a number of years, it saved lives in their community. And that really is the Watts Peace Treaty.
One thing I also really loved about your telling of this was the note that a principal architect, as you put it, of the armistice agreement in 1949 was Ralph Bunche, who was originally a student at Jefferson High School, which is located in South Los Angeles. And so that was all the more reason for these later generations of young Black men in particular to note that, hey, this is something we may in fact be able to achieve for ourselves here too. As you put it, Bunche was also awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for his work on that armistice agreement between Israel and Egypt. And so I really appreciated that note. And what I also want to ask you in turn is, why does this matter in 2022? Why are we talking about Watts in particular at this point when 30 years have gone by and it seems that, say, gangs in Los Angeles are not what they once were, and crime all across the United States is not what it once was, especially crime associated with gangs. Why are we talking about this in the first place? What led you to publish this incredible piece?
So a couple of thoughts. One is, I think it offers a different narrative on the gang experience. When people think about gangs, they think nothing but violence, aggression, antisocial behavior. And the fact is that gangs are made up of individuals, of human beings, who want a better life. I don't deny that there has been violence and there has been crime associated with some gangs. But I also can't deny that there are members of gangs that are looking for a better life. And this is one example, one powerful example of that. And while it is true that the violence in Watts is certainly not where it was 30 years ago, 40 years ago, it doesn't mean that our communities are free of violence and the problems. In fact, that is one of the tragedies of the Watts Treaty, which is that the Watts Treaty was necessary because politicians were ignoring these communities. They weren't providing the communities with meaningful economic support. They weren't providing them with meaningful educational opportunities. And in many respects, we continue to see that dynamic today. And so the problems are still there. And so I think that's important. Moreover, I think for me, one of the meaningful aspects of the Watts Peace Treaty was it highlights the power of social movements and the power of individuals to solve their own problems when government is unwilling or unable to do so. And it is interesting to look back and to think about what was it about the individuals that were involved in negotiating this treaty? What was it about their experience that led to that successful outcome? Because I think that those are lessons learned that we can use today. And so, for example, one important point is to recognize how important grassroots activism is, how powerful it is. And it is important for politicians, for communities to be aware that sometimes the most effective solutions are internal and that you need the buy-in of these communities and you need to integrate community leaders at all levels in trying to solve local problems. And so I think that in the case of the Watts Peace Treaty, one of the reasons it was successful is because the gang members were credible. They brought credibility to the process. They brought their experience within their community to the process. They were able to enforce the treaty within their community. And it was much easier for them to do it than, of course, law enforcement. And even back then, 30 years ago, there was that antagonism. There was that tension between the local communities and the law enforcement community. I think that's an important lesson for us today, recognizing the power of symbolism, recognizing the power of respect, providing respect to these local communities. And so I think that the lessons of the Watts Peace Treaty aren't just historical, they're contemporary, and they offer lessons for us today as we think about how to address the problems of today. It's true that again, comparing violence in these cities today, very different from where it was 30 years ago, but that doesn't mean that we still don't have violence, poverty in our cities that require some type of a meaningful response.
That's absolutely right, William. All of this is so critical for us to consider at this moment. And I think especially as well of the 2016 election. And not long after 2016, the Trump administration's sort of reliance on that very narrative, that sort of cliched narrative involving gangs and the danger posed by gangs. In particular, the administration was going after the so-called MS-13 gang. And of course, where that sort of history lies and where its current trajectory is based is different from, let's say, historically Black gangs in places such as South Los Angeles. And yet your story is absolutely integral to the process of excavation and essentially looking at what our history, especially our local history, can say about the power we have to affect change within our communities. And so to be certain, you said actually that there's a full article that is still left for us to sift through. So maybe you can say a few words as to what else we need to know regarding this historic treaty in 1992, just a handful of days prior to the 1992 rebellion in Los Angeles.
Well, one thing I really want to emphasize is I really see myself simply as a scribe in telling the stories of others. And using our modern terminology, I want to give a shout out to those individuals, Akilah Sherrills, Daoud Sherrills, Twilight Bay. These men put together this treaty. These men took great risks for their own personal safety, to convince their peers, their colleagues, that this was something worth doing to protect their families, to protect their friends, to protect their communities. And so I think part of the storytelling process is to give voice to the individuals that deserve celebration, that deserve recognition. When I've had a chance to speak to them, I always try to emphasize that their work saved lives, that there are people who are alive today in 2022 who would not be alive but for their efforts. Children that were born that would never have gotten that opportunity but for the efforts of these individual diplomats, really, that put this treaty together. And so I think that's a legacy that also needs to be recognized and celebrated. So I think that academics really have a responsibility to tell the stories of those who may not have the opportunity, to tell the stories that can easily be hidden. Because frankly, telling a story about how gang leaders drafted an international agreement effectively, or used an international agreement to solve local gang violence, that cuts against the grain, as you mentioned earlier about how many politicians view gangs. And I think that's important. It's important to cut against the grain whenever we can, to offer the different narratives that are out there, because they give meaning, they give value. And I think these stories are worth recording because they're worth telling. And so certainly I think most people understand Watts is the place where the uprisings occur on two separate occasions, that Watts is where that tower is located. I would love people to remember Watts as a place where that peace treaty originated. I think that's important.
I think that's excellent, William. And I think in particular, as we talk about treaties, as we talk about diplomats, I realize that what especially these young Black men were doing in 1992 was not radically different, although certainly several lifetimes and modes removed from what these framers or founding fathers did in 1787 at the Constitutional Convention, where they were drafting a way forward, where they were drafting an attempt at unity. And yet, of course, we know to this day, especially after the uprisings in the name of George Floyd, that the text that we've used, the text that we've applied through documents and interpretations of the US Constitution, these remain embedded in racist legacies. And so you've also done some writing about how to engage this and how to challenge this in ways that just may prove substantial for generations to come. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about really engaging the US Constitution for its racist legacies.
Of course. And I really appreciate the way in which you framed the drafters of the Watts Treaty can trace a legacy, one could argue, back to the framers of the Constitution on some level. It sure sounds like a great new musical for Lin-Manuel Miranda to make, a sequel to Hamilton, perhaps. I would say that one of the striking features about our Constitution is that it is a blatantly racist document. And I appreciate that for some people that might be difficult to hear, but I need to emphasize that is not rhetoric. That is not someone just trying to be provocative. That is a statement of fact. If we look at the text of the Constitution, it contains several provisions that to this day exist in the constitutional text and that are blatantly racist. The 3/5 clause, for example, that treats of African Americans as only partly citizens, 3/5 of a person. The Fugitive Slave Clause that empowered individuals to capture slaves and slave people that had escaped and bring them back to captivity. These are explicitly, and they remain explicitly in the text of the Constitution. And so I think it's important for us to call that out. We talk about the Constitution as this wonderful document that we hope to share with other countries transitioning from totalitarian regimes to democratic regimes. And we use our own Constitution as a template. Well, I think we have to confront the fact that that very document that we celebrate continues to this day to include explicitly racist statements and language. And oftentimes people will say, well, but that doesn't really matter anymore because the 13th Amendment eliminated slavery, the 14th Amendment ensures equality. Well, that may be true, but that doesn't take away from the fact that that blatantly racist language is still in that document. And so one of my articles, I propose that we draft an amendment that actually, using Microsoft Word language, cut and paste, just delete that language, literally get rid of it. As we think about the Constitution for a 21st century, a 22nd century, let's make it a Constitution that we can honestly and universally embrace. And I think people should remember that the Constitution that we celebrate to this day, while it has incredibly important elements to it, continues explicitly to be a racist document. And of course, I'm simply focusing on the text. I'm not addressing how we interpret it. I'm not addressing other aspects of it. It is also a gendered document. It talks about men. It doesn't talk about women. And so that brings us to a whole nother realm of problems with that document. I think one can be proud of the democratic principles that form the foundation of the Constitution, and yet still acknowledge that a document that is over 220 years old probably merits an update. And so I proposed literally removing the racist language from our Constitution. And quite frankly, while we're at it, we could do a lot of other things too to improve it as well.
Well, especially as you note in that very article that you've mentioned here, there's still use. There are still applications of the U.S. Constitution that are inhumane, that justify the treatment of people as almost akin to property. And so I do believe that in all of this, we really are looking at the documents which speak to the moment, and also asking ourselves, how do we engage? How do we improve? How do we use these words? Because we're going back to words and going back to stories and even narratives. How do we sort of really address these in ways that humanize people more than anything else in a modern context? And not just in a modern context, but in a context for all people, for all future generations, which will inherit these histories.
Absolutely. It's interesting. If we look at the 13th Amendment, the 13th Amendment was adopted at the end of the Civil War to end slavery. But the 13th Amendment actually continues to allow for involuntary servitude under certain circumstances. And that's extraordinary. That should be excised from the Constitution. It is interesting that in fact, the 13th Amendment is the only place in the Constitution where the word slavery actually appears. The framers were very careful not to include that word in the original document because they recognized the pernicious nature of slavery. And they recognized that it was a fatal flaw in that original document. And so, as you pointed out, as we think about the relevance of this 200 plus year old document, I do think it's time for us to have serious conversations about whether we need to make it a modern document. And there are so many places where we could do that.
That's absolutely right. And as I think of place, and as I think of that 13th Amendment at the end of the Civil War, I, of course, am not breaking any news to you that the state of California houses more inmates than any other state in the nation. And therefore, what we consider labor and indentured servitude or unpaid labor, that remains a tenet of being a ward of the state in places such as California. For all the progressive values it might be noted for or recognized for across the nation, these documents are still absolutely reverberating in our state and across our communities, across courtrooms, all over places like LA County. And so these discussions matter very much with respect to the situation then. I really appreciate your time, William. I have absolutely enjoyed this conversation, and we find ourselves at the end already. And so I just want to provide you with an opportunity to give us a heads up as to how we may connect with you or your work or what else we should be on the lookout for with respect to some of these discussions. And again, I have got to thank you because it's just been a whole lot of fun.
Oh, likewise. I really enjoyed having the chance to be on your show. I think with respect to the Watts Peace Treaty, I think that it's something that all of us should, as we're reading the newspaper, as we're listening to local news, we should always be open to those stories that might just pass us by because we don't think twice about them. To me, it highlights the importance of media, of independent media, of where we get our media or where we get our news. So I'm really grateful for you being one source of independent news. I think that's incredibly important. And in terms of where we're heading as a country and trying to bring all this together, I do think that we have to recognize that the current structure that we have in place, that as you know, you mentioned earlier, going back to the U.S. Constitution, I think we're at a point where we need to make adjustments. We need to make revisions. We need to make amendments to those documents, those core documents. While they were valuable and in the time and place where they were drafted, they were extraordinary and visionary, and many aspects of them remain extraordinary and visionary. Other aspects are dated. and outdated, and it's time for a change. And I think there are a lot of opportunities moving forward for us to have those conversations.